Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
Dear listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Through the Wind Door. Although it's more complicated this time, because for the first time in ever, we have chosen a block of chapters that we want to talk about and ended up coming to a natural stopping place due to real-life time constraints, where we ended up just deciding, okay, we've covered some of the questions on our list, and then ended up going, I think we need to stop for today, so we'll come back to this later on. So this whole time previous, where due to my editing schedule and everything else, I had been dividing one long conversation over Skype into two chunks with all the edits I usually put in, here we actually have a part two that is a natural progression of two different Skype sessions. Nothing, you know, the technology didn't fail. It's just we ended up talking so much about one particular part of chapters 11 through 15. Plus, we ended up having this whole extra conversation prior to the podcast that some of that may get edited in or not, depending on how that all works together. There is stuff potentially worth using, but as it turns out, it involves stuff that we haven't gotten to yet in the story, so we're going to save it for a later episode. It just ends up like, okay, we're clearly talking a lot about this, and it's running into real-world deadlines or barriers and stuff like that. So this is just how... I don't necessarily know that we're going to be doing anything like this going forward. We will. Who knows? We'll see how individual schedules and the question lists end up turning out. The list isn't hugely long. When the interview with Sharon and Alex went to three different recording times, where we did like an hour and a half the first time, an hour and a half the second time, and close to 2 hours the third time.
How? That was the shortest amount of questions.
Exactly, but they had a lot to say, and I think that we expanded our, like, we thought of new questions to ask during the process. Like, that's, when that happened, that's part of the reason why I trimmed out a lot of the excess stuff, particularly the Part B add-on questions that we never got to from some of the previous ones, where I just trimmed all of that out and be like, okay, this, and this. There was like five or six questions toward the end, and we still ended up taking more time than all of the previous. This is us. We go on and on, and Alex can go on and on. So when we're together, we just go on.
We are incorrigible enablers of any like conversation. Just whenever people say, "Oh, but I could go on," we say, "Do
please do, yes."
Go on.
So, when last we left you, we got a little bit away from our original outline, because we skipped forward over the capture of Frau and a bunch of the other named characters of Rama, and instead started discussing more of Miguel's story, because we had gotten onto a bit of a tangent with Francisco Delgado, and that's more or less where we ended up. So before we circle back around to that particular development in the story, because it sort of blends a little bit, Frau's part, and then later Miguel's part as he experiences all of that. Let's talk a little bit more about the experience of the past as embodied by Miguel's story, which we did cover some of last time as well, but there's definitely more to talk about. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out was the shifting of narrative between Hrau being the first-person narrator and Miguel being the first-person narrator. In addition to some of the stuff that we talked about last time, where Miguel is willingly offering up a whole lot more about his past, like as well as he can remember it, there's entire portions of it where he's a child and, you know, he's doing his best to try and recall how it happened. And he also, in the margins of what he's saying, there is the implication that he knows certain things without being able to know them, such as when he and his father flee their home city, and he's remembering the screaming woman as being such and such, like someone he knows but doesn't have a personal relationship with, that his mind may have edited out that woman was in fact his own mother, that Francisco fled out of fear or just plain selfishness or whatever. If there's one thing that I very much enjoy about Alex's writing in general, something we skipped over the top of, Alex is very good at using subtlety or subtext as a part of his narrations, in terms of how he frames things so that we can imply certain details without him saying them outright. That was the case when, towards the end of Chapter 11, when Hrau was still trying to find Coral, and a tiger comes to her and is not identified by her in this flashback dream sequence, but we know is Haka because of the designation of the golden eyes, which was always, we know specifically about Haka because of the way those golden eyes come up whenever he is possessing animals and such like. And on top of that, there was another moment where when we were discussing the earlier stuff with the Gagaku, and the way that the Gagaku is name-dropped during that portion of Chapter 11, and how it reflects back on the earlier representation of the Gagaku, both through the myth as told to young Hrau by her parents, and then later as she faces this fearsome creature as portrayed by the Silent One to scare off, you know, other cats and stuff like that from bothering her. You can potentially miss these small things if you're being carried away by the storytelling, and I definitely was in places, but mm-hmm. getting back into it and diving deep, some of these things just stood out starkly clear as not Easter eggs, but as these little subtleties thrown in that add extra deepness and context to appreciate if you notice them.
I think that it's a writing equivalent of using negative space, where something that I personally struggle with in my own writing, not necessarily of fiction, just mm-hmm. in any essay or article I write, is that with my language over the years, I've come across this problem that I, due to my dyspraxia, I have this issue where I will have these feelings and complex thoughts I will struggle to put into words. So I lean in so hard into the direction of over-explanation that I will try to add in additional words that kind of will zero in exactly precisely what I mean. And to me, that is a crutch that I lean on, but I am aware that it has this effect of becoming a word salad, and it just becomes like even more difficult to grasp the meaning of it. And in writing, as in fictional writing, I think that you can have that same risk, that if you are so fearful that your audience isn't going to grasp your meaning or what you're trying to communicate, you can over-explain things. You can sort of rob a moment of its impact by having it so like scrutinized and so laid bare that it feels like you're looking not at the scene, but the blueprints, the actual coding for the scene, and it feels like you're like there's too much detail. You need to see what is the most important detail in the moment, and for Hrau, it's the knowledge that even if she doesn't look this tiger in the eyes, she knows who it is, and those eyes are what define him. So when I say negative space, what I guess I'm referring to is that these details are there, even if they're not expressed, and it's because when you come back to it, you have this familiarity with the key details of these characters that you can intuit when something isn't being said. And that is just as much a statement as what the characters choose to say. So however much Miguel decides to dwell on whether or not this person really was his mother is something that you do wonder, that he is able to confront the past with a bit more ease than Hrau is. But there are certainly moments that he, like, he tries to remember the details of his grandmother because he is trying to pinpoint a portrait of her.
Being able to remember his grandmother is also of supreme importance to him. As we talked a bit about last time, if Francisco was the reality of a bad parent giving him bad advice, then he needed an example of some kind to counterbalance that. And in his case, he latched onto members of his abuelita to do so.
But the woman that they ran away from, it feels like he momentarily acknowledges that this woman really could have been his mother, but it's somewhere that he doesn't necessarily want to stay, even if he doesn't explicitly say that. And that's what negative space is when it comes to narration. It's your understanding that what you're being told isn't an omniscient third person narrator whose job is to ensure that you are given every detail. It's a character telling you this, and that character will have their own biases and things that will inform what they choose to tell and not tell you. That is just as much part of the characterization as the events and the plot that you see in it.
That was a mouthful, and I have so many different thoughts about
it. See, I told you I over-explained things.
but that's not... Okay, so the only reason I said what I said is merely because you said one thing, and I was like, oh, okay, I need to keep track of that so that I can bring it back up as soon as he's done. And then you bring up another thing, like, oh, okay, I can need to keep track of that so I can bring it up when he's done. And now I've got just this pile of things here that I want to discuss, and now I'm like, okay, in what order do I actually talk about these things?
That's absolutely my problem as well in discussion, and you're very patient with me is in discussion, in writing. To me, it's always a case of, ooh, I should communicate this next point, but it sort of ties into these other points. So why deliver one point when I can load you with five? And
yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yes, forgive me for my bad habits, Greg and dear listeners. I assure you I am trying to work on them.
Well, I'll do my best to respond to this stuff now. And the great thing about editing is that when I come back to this, if I find that there's anything that I missed along the way, I can always put in another little blurb and try and address it as best I can, even if it's not in real time. First thing is, yes, I definitely agree that whoever it is that's crafting a story, whether it's a book, a film, a TV show, whatever it is, that sometimes they're worried about the audience not necessarily getting whatever it is that they're seeing, and so therefore needing to over-explain or use whatever language of whatever medium they're doing in order to be absolutely sure that the audience gets it. I think that tends to come up a little bit more in movies sometimes because they're worried about the overall bottom line, perhaps, in terms of like making sure that people enjoy whatever it is they say, and it's appealing, not necessarily to the lowest common denominator, but at the very least, that people don't leave a movie confused by what they saw or anything like that. It's not quite like, and I'm forgetting his name again, because his name came up during the Aronofsky. Aronofsky came up during our Q&A session where we were discussing... I brought up mother in context, and if people have listened to Alex's quick review on Mother and the audience's response to what they were seeing, everything that was going on in that movie was meant to be heavily couched as being a metaphor, but people didn't get that. They were responding to it as something that was actually happening, and so therefore they left the theater going, well, that was a fucking piece of shit, and...
Fucking inconsistent realities. I can't wrap my head around this. I say.
And it's also true, as being a part of storytelling, that sometimes, you know, if a message is important enough, or if it's the kind of thing that doesn't get through to most people, there's a trope called some anvils need to be dropped, in which case sometimes you need to make something absolutely clear in order to not, like, push people's face into it necessarily, but so that the viewer sort of has to come face to face with the fact that if it was a more subtle explanation, they might not necessarily get it. Or it's a message that, like, it's the kind of thing where the anvil that needs to be dropped is something in regards to sexism or racism or, you know, the big topics that divide us and weigh us down very much, even today. And I'm trying not to talk about recent election stuff, so moving swiftly along from there. Yeah, exactly so. I thought about removing this bit, since obviously by now, the election has happened, and it would seem that we may have a chance to step back from the abyss. But if there's one thing that last month has made even clearer, it's that we're operating from an even bigger deficit than usual in terms of shaping the cultural and national conversation. A lot of people just refuse to accept reality and dig in their heels, believing that they can change it if they just don't accept it. And above and beyond our current political reality, it makes me wonder what this means for fictional media, too. Metaphor, subtext, or even dropping anvils only works if your mind is open to possibilities. You have to be willing to have your mind expanded, changed, to accepting that maybe the world isn't like you have always believed, thanks to youthful arrogance, provincial mindset, or conservative families and communities. That's not the world we live in these days. It seems like everyone lives in bubbles, where one part of humanity is working hard to be more and more accepting and screwing it up sometimes, one side being so conservative that they aren't just refusing to change, they are reinventing their own reality that doesn't actually exist, and in the middle are people that think both sides are equally bad, and as a result aren't seeing nuance at all. This is extremely frustrating. At its heart, media is communication. Not simply entertainment, but sharing ideas through stories. But thanks to the current culture and the increasing focus on using media only in terms of monetization, there's so much stuff out there that is only either pandering or trying to be everything to everyone, which means it's about nothing. And those aren't stories I'm interested in. Toby and I are doing New Century for a reason. It challenges us, makes us think, and fuels our communication to each other and to you.
No, exactly. These anvils usually tend to be, they're dropped when it's like, okay, we keep on bringing these up and people keep seeming to not quite get it. Let's make the anvil heavier and let's put it nearer and nearer the center and just make sure it's right in the bullseye of the scene. You can't miss it.
Yeah. We'll have a dance number all around it.
Yeah.
Look at this anvil. Yeah. So, okay, damn it. Now I am forgetting some of the context.
Oh, damn it. Sorry, I've interrupted.
No, it's perfectly okay. In terms of Miguel himself, one could draw a through line between Hrau not wanting to address the trauma of Corral and him being unable to remember his mother's face or his mother's influence on his life. But there is a separate thing going on there, in that in Rao's case, it doesn't feel like she's forgotten anything. One might even say that thanks to her trauma, she couldn't forget. As we discussed earlier, part of her is in stasis, and all she can do is try not to think about her past in order to function. She is doing her best just not to think about it by deliberately directing her mind in a specific direction, and as is alluded to in the text, only when she is not in control of her own mind, when she sleeps, do these memories come back, which is why she tends to avoid sleep, because it's more difficult for her. In the case of Miguel, in terms of what he remembers and doesn't remember, much of this early stuff is like when he was, I don't remember his exact age, but he was like 3, 4, 5. I know enough about myself that there's probably plenty of stuff that I don't remember from that age, except for maybe little flashes of memory that come up every now and then, or, you know, something that, like a moment from my own childhood, and it was sort of like one of those things that I kept telling people about because I thought it was interesting or funny or whatever, and so that now is codified in my brain as a thing that actually happened. But in terms of losing his mother at a very young age during a very, very chaotic moment, especially when he was relying on his father for protection, it doesn't surprise me that he isn't for certain about what his father was telling him was real. And it's only because of, as he is telling this story now, that he understands that his father is a villain, and so therefore isn't sure that he can completely trust him, or if he can trust his faulty memories of that time. On top of that, I've had a chance to learn these past few years that when you undergo trauma or abuse, it's not unusual to have memory issues. This is your brain protecting itself, prioritizing certain memories, experiences, and lessons over others, so that you can continue to function. I've experienced this myself, as there are entire parts of my life that were difficult enough for me that names and faces have been utterly wiped from my brain. Listening to this moment even makes me think of a certain scene from Terminator Dark Fate, where Sarah Connor is despairing about not being able to remember John's face. I won't get further into it than that, as you should definitely watch this movie if you haven't already, and then go listen to the School of Movies podcast on it. The bottom line is thus. Sometimes forgetting is the only thing you can do to move on, especially when you are young and don't have the tools to deal with this kind of thing. So that's what I feel is part of what's going on there. But that means that that's what sort of couches the subtlety in terms of not necessarily leaving it up in the air as a mystery, because it's not like that particular moment is ever going to necessarily get payoff. The importance there is that it further characterizes his father as being a gaslighter and being a manipulator.
That his father is the source of this ambiguity, this uncertainty.
Yeah. Here we also got back into the discussion of why it is he remembers his abuelita so well, which I'm trimming a bit since that stuff we already covered. The TLDR is that he needs to remember his abuelita as a wedge against the bad influence and gaslighting of Francisco.
And I think it's important to him that he holds on to a part of where he's from and who he's connected to that is not just his father, that it is someone that has these positive qualities that he wants to keep clear in his mind. And it's important that we hear about his grandmother, because it's a reassurance to know that Miguel has been loved and treasured, that he has had that precious seed of having been loved planted in his past, even if he hasn't been nurtured for quite some time, or at the very least I think the wrong parts of him have been nurtured, as in, like, Francisco encourages him to steal, to manipulate others. He's, any development he is trying to instill in Miguel is very much to make him more useful to him rather than to make him more of a person on his own terms or his own, as his own man. Love and compassion are there in Miguel as much as Francisco's treatment might have stamped that out. And I think that's why Miguel does have that light to him. And when you see his resolve to tell his father that he will not steal again, these are just moments we see that as much as his father has been this dominating presence in his life, it is not all of him, that he has this resolve inside him, and he also does have a connection to someone who he loves and who loved him.
You're right that he would have had to have some sort of counter-influence in order to avoid, say, the fate of Tommy Sweeney from Secret Rooms and the bad advice and experience that he was getting from his father that led him to getting punched by Abigail. He would have had something to counter that. Longtime fans of School of Movies would be familiar with the language of personal totems in storytelling. One of the things present in this story that we have not talked about so far is that Tiger's Eye does use that a bit. Hrau's Armlet, Opal Eye's Eye, and so on. In this case, Miguel also has a totem, the rosary beads given to him by his grandmother. That gives him a focus of grounding for the positive influence she had on him, and is an ongoing touchstone for Miguel throughout the book. Obviously, when you're talking about people, when you're talking about kids, the thing that always comes up is the whole nature-nurture stuff. But I also don't believe in the idea that people are necessarily naturally one thing or the other. There is some stuff that comes from within in terms of the way they interpret what they get in the world. But the world also has to have something for them to interpret. And the most obvious place that tends to come from would be their family, their siblings, their parents, you know, the immediate nuclear or non-nuclear influence that helps them to grow into the world that they have. It's the people that they have the most experience with. So yeah, we like Miguel because we understand his inherent goodness, but I think it is important to note that one might almost think that it's kind of a little bit lucky that he turns out the way he does.
I was just going to agree. It really is a stroke of luck that he isn't just mini Francisco.
Yeah, because that's always the biggest influence, but he does understand from somewhere eventually that what his father is doing is wrong. And of course, as we got into last time, the level of wrongness that Francisco Delgado will step to is still a little bit in doubt. I thought the possibility that Francisco might have been willing to kill the Zhang family or members of the Zhang family in order to take their stuff, that's the kind of Weasley thing that he would totally do if he thought he could get away with it. But obviously we don't actually know at that point. Here I will interject, because Alex responded to something we talked about in the previous episode in regards to whether Francisco merely stole from the Zhang family or if he outright murdered them for their possessions. As we've mentioned before, on most subjects, Alex wants us to come up with our own interpretations of what he wrote. But on this matter, he did confirm Francisco did not commit murder. And he said this not to defend Francisco, but merely to say that if Miguel knew he did this, the boy's response would have been equally different. Stealing from a family that represented the kindness and generosity that he was lacking in his own life was already a line too far for Miguel. But if Francisco took a further step and took lives for his greed, then Miguel would have possibly left or even killed his father. Fortunately, this is not that story. thinking about it, the fact that it's that moment when Miguel first stands up to his father and says, no, I won't do this anymore. It may well be that the kindness that the women of the Zhang family showed him in terms, it sort of reawoken that memory of the life that they had prior to always being on the run. And that influenced him taking a stand and saying, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. Because it definitely seems like he had a positive, nurturing, friendly experience with them. And so therefore, that was the last straw as far as that experience was concerned. Now, before we move too much further into Miguel's story, the one thing I did want to come back to from a moment ago, we haven't talked as much about some of your personal stuff. And I don't necessarily want to get too deep into it because it is personal and doesn't necessarily reflect on our remit here talking about New Century and Tiger's Eye. But you brought up your condition of having dyspraxia as being an explanation for why it is you have certain conversational, not tics. Gambits is the word, tics. That's a better word, conversational tics. I don't think I knew this about you necessarily. I knew that you had a few issues that you have been struggling with over the years, but not this one in particular. And I'm curious, we may end up cutting this out if it's not germane.
No,
if it's not. But
I'm perfectly happy to talk about it.
Fair enough. Just based on my tiny amount of Google foo, it appears to be something involving physical coordination. So I'm curious how that influences your thought or speech patterns.
Well, it's something that I, for as much as it's been there for most of my life, it's not necessarily something that I have a full understanding of every way this manifests. The first thing is that it does sort of manifest in slightly different ways. So it will, someone else with dyspraxia may not struggle with language at all. And for other people, it might be that their hand-eye coordination is much more severely impacted than mine is. So on a physical level, it does mean that my, you know, when someone throws a ball at me, it did when I was a kid, that was something that I struggled with, that I would fumble and all of that. And I think just tying shoelaces and the things that you learn day to day did require a bit of extra practice there. The reason why it affects language for me is that I think for me, it manifests in this way where my head takes a bit longer to process things. If it gets information, whether it's sound or visuals, and the information will come in, I will have to process it and then devise a reaction to it. So someone that is throwing me a ball, it will take me a moment to process, oh, I need to catch that. And sometimes the ball's right in front of me and it's too late for me to properly catch it.
Yeah.
Or it'll slam me right in the face. But with language, it can be a case of if I was reading, and I never really had too much problem with reading. I think that's much more something that manifests with dyslexia. But it's more a case of if I was doing a written exam, I would read the words, the information, it would go into my head and it would go through that filter and I would process that and go, oh, okay, yes, that's what is being said there. Now, what do I need to say for that? And the chain of thoughts and what leads from one to the other just takes a fraction longer. And, you know, everyone listening can probably say for themselves whether this next statement has any weight behind it. But I like to think that I am not unintelligent.
Toby, what did we say about self-deprecation? You're a grad student and an invaluable part of this team. you're plenty intelligent in multiple ways. And if it sometimes takes a little bit longer to get there, well, we can't all be James Penrose. I'm certainly not.
I think that the actual level of the thoughts that I'm able to arrive at and to express are reasonable. Or reasonably thought out is the better way of putting that. It is just that getting to those conclusions, having those analytical thoughts, requires a bit more computational time. And so sometimes what that means is that when I am presented with information or something that someone says, it will come into my head and I'll have a response. It will be intellectual or emotional, that this scene involves this thing, someone says something quite pertinent, and it feeds back on other things, and it will sort of register, and I will be thinking on that. And sometimes what that means is that I'll be sort of stuck thinking on something important that happened half a minute ago, and then realize, oh wait, we're moving on, let's like not lose ourselves. And I think sometimes with reading, that's why everyone has that syndrome they get where they'll spend half an hour on one page because they keep going over it, or they realize, wait, I wasn't really paying attention, let's make sure I actually take in the information. That certainly happens. All of this to say is that when I want to express a thought, it's important to me that I articulate it in the correct manner, because sometimes if I do things very off the cuff and don't actually put in the requisite computational time, then it will feel like it's not really thought out at all. And that frightens me. And it's always, I think I had this great insecurity, I remember when I was younger, whenever this sort of anything to do with this, or just life in general, I worried that me being slow meant that I was going to be looked down on as stupid, as just like that people would see me needing a bit more time to do things as, oh, that guy is behind, he's not as smart as everyone else in the room. And it didn't really ever come to be that much. It was just like any weakness that people have, you're always far more conscious of it than anyone else will ever be. The fact that, you know, it's something that you may not have like been conscious of until I brought it up myself, is nice to hear. But it's another reason why I am open about this. And as much as this is a going away from New Century and Tiger's Eye, I would still encourage you to include this as long as you think it pertinent, because it is important to talk about any and all of these things, because as with any conditions and things that we take into our lives, by choice or not, sometimes the things that are our weaknesses or just things put against us, our responses and our ways we overcome it end up being our strengths. So I like to think that as much as I have struggled with language in the past, that my ability to actually pause and deliberate and then present information when I am content with how it sounds does end up meaning that I've been able to go into this business of writing and discussing analytically. And it's something that happens with a lot of work and practice, and sometimes you end up falling back because the human mind is all interconnected. When one part is feeling like it needs care and attention, it means that other parts will fall back as well. And so I'm sure that anyone listening knows exactly how, when presented with unbearable circumstances, it can put you in a low space, and the other things in your life that you thought you had gotten over years ago will start to flare up again. It's something that is intimidating, but that's why I say it's always important for me to remember that as much as this is an inescapable thing that I know I will have to contend with, and it is very minor in comparison, like, even for dyspraxia, I know that the way it manifests for me is much, much more minor than it will be for a lot of other people. But even so, it's there. It would be unfair to say that it doesn't exist.
It's an untidy part of yourself, but it's part of a greater whole that has value in and of itself. I definitely understand that.
Completely. Sentiment. It is something that I some days deeply regret its presence, but by talking about it and by reflecting on it, you realize that you can't pull it away because it's so tied into your infrastructure and the best parts of yourself that if you pulled it away, you don't know what would be left.
Yeah, I completely get that. And I definitely think I want to leave this in either as part of the podcast proper or put into the outtakes later on. Because the thing that I want to add into this for listeners is that I've mentioned from time to time, either as part of the podcast or getting into it a little bit on the New Century Discord channel, that a lot of work goes into editing Through the Windor. And much of that, you know, sometimes it's editing in those little asides, which is a thing that I came up with as a result of listening to Alex's podcasting style. If I feel like there's something that needs to be added, or there's a section that I want to remove in order to put something more pithy in its place. But the thing that tends to take up a lot more time is trying to make the overall context a lot more accessible to the audience. And most often what that results in is removing a whole lot of extra noise words, removing a whole lot of unnecessary space as well, so that if there is a silence, it doesn't seem to drag on or anything like that. And in addition to that, there are verbal tics that both I have and Toby has that come up often enough that it can sometimes just emphasize those moments where either one of us are sort of spinning our wheels in place as we're trying to understand what point we're trying to come to, or maybe there's an unfinished thought that I just, like, I end up excising that entire portion of our conversation because it's not of use to the listener to hear. And more important is when we skip forward to the part where your brain just sort of kicks into gear again and you find the right way to say whatever it is you're saying. And that's why, as long as we can talk sometimes on an individual subject, I do my best to remove all those extraneous bits so the important stuff always shines through. So if you haven't noticed that Toby has this particular issue, or if you haven't noticed my particular issues in terms of these conversational stuff, it's because I've gone to a lot of effort in order to clean all that up. And that may be less verisimilitudinous, it may seem less real as a result, but I still think that the overall product works better as a result of making it as, not dramatic, but making it as listenable as possible by getting rid of the cruft.
Bringing down the overall podcast runtime is also important, as well as making sure that we are understood, and therefore removing verbal obstacles from our path. And in a way, this does link back to Tiger's Eye specifically, considering what a significant role communication plays in this story, as well as in New Century in general.
In my mind, it feels like when we perform these conversational tics, it's like when you're using sketch lines, when you're putting together a piece of artwork, that it won't be there in the final draft of it, but it's vital when you're putting everything together. So we may have these moments where we spin our wheels, as you say, with putting something in where you say like, or it's interesting, or anything like that. It just, And me going, it just, all of these things that feel very much like it's stalling for time. It's a remnant of the construction. And I think that you sharpening our conversations and smoothing out the edges doesn't necessarily get rid of the skeleton, the main or the musculature even of the body of our conversation, but it certainly gets rid of the fat.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. People seem to have enjoyed what we've put together so far. And Alex has said some incredibly nice things about the polished gems that I've managed to put out of the two of us getting into stuff. So it feels like we're doing something right.
Hey, if we're compared to macarons, then we're doing something right.
Exactly so, exactly so. Back on track. Now that I've finally gotten a chance to talk about all of the ideas that were spinning around in my head when I was listening to you talk. Miguel, we eventually get to the point where he is on board the Natchez with his two young friends. And what occurs to me here is that now that we have gotten to this point in Miguel's story, we have a better comprehension of where this story as a whole fits into the overall New Century oeuvre. It's almost a direct response to one of the earlier points that we'll come back to, where when we finally find out where all these cats are disappearing to, and we discover that, in fact, it's not a result of humans invading the space of Rama and colonizing it, as we would expect humans to do. It is the result of great cats of that world, the Lions of Albion, doing the same to the other felines of Rama as humans did to Aboriginal peoples back in the days. So in terms of that whole thing, it not only flips that entire narrative on its head and shows how certain aspects to, you can't say humanity in this case, because, and the word that Alex himself uses later for cats to describe themselves is felinity instead, because all of the sapient creatures of Rama are cats. But it speaks to the, there's a quote that I love to bring up every now and then that I learned a long time ago from, I want to say, X-Men 200, which was the trial of Magneto and the human court system judging him for everything that he had done as a mutant supremacist and the crimes committed and everything like that. I like the quote because it's immediately applicable to a lot of different situations, and I don't know where the quote actually comes from, but the translation is, the more things change, the more they stay the same. One could almost say that this is a direct allegory to this concept. We're on a completely different world with a completely different species being dominant, and yet the same patterns are repeating here. What I circle back around to now is that now that we have established that the time for Miguel is well after, like, I don't have the timeline in front of me, and it's not exact, but the point in the New Century history where Miguel goes through the door, the wind door on the Natchez into the land of Rama, is pretty darn contemporary with events as they are playing out elsewhere in the story. I may have thrown up the timeline already at some point in the show notes and previous stories. But when we actually start talking about this, which maybe when we get into Arlington or maybe when we get all the way to Steamheart, but even as James and Abigail are having their adventures over at the House of Restect, it's right around the same time that Miguel is going through his wind door. And so therefore, in this world, the Wendigo have been around for 9-10 years, and it's a part of, it's an intrinsic part of the world as it is right now. That combined with the portal itself being in a precarious place, like it's on a rotting boat, and the portal being right out of a waterfall, means that if humans found that and wanted to exploit it for whatever reason, it would be very difficult for them to make use out of that particular door and be an invading force coming through to the other side. Before you come to your thought on the subject, even if they could, humanity is in a much weakened state. They're having a hard enough time dealing with their own breakdown of order and resources and infrastructure, such that even if the portal itself was wider known, they may just want to leave it alone. They wouldn't be able to marshal the forces, or might just be too afraid of it to try to exploit it should they know of it. And that is an interesting way to flip the expected conflict on its head by putting humanity into a weakened state, and therefore the threat to Durga tribe and Yamaya village and all of the aboriginal cats of Rama comes from within that world. The next bit unfortunately ended up a little garbled thanks to sound file cutting out in places. And normally I try to edit around that a little bit, or have Toby re-record. But I was worried about time constraints, not to mention that, due to the cutouts, I can't be certain I know all the words that went missing. And it unfortunately just kept happening. But having listened to this entire section multiple times, let me see if I can explain what he was trying to say. No, there is too much. Let me sum up. Toby's response was basically that it was actually important that the Albion Lions were the threat. Having humans be the threat, while predictable, doesn't actually tell us anything new except the idea of humanity just always being the worst. But by having cats enslave other cats, by having them mirror events in our world, there is a commentary being made there. Multiple, in fact. One being civilizations always being built on the backs of underclasses, no matter what the dominant race is. But also, we now know that Haka's seeming fears were unfounded. The danger to this world doesn't come from the Windor or from humans. This is put in direct contrast with the previous story, where we now know that Windors brought the Wendigo, and the Wendigo brought nations to their knees. Here, the danger comes from within. Albion is a part and parcel of that world, and would have happened regardless of whether the Windor from Earth opened or not. What did come through the Windor? What was at the bottom of this box? Miguel. And if one chose to follow the metaphor to the end, perhaps Miguel will end up being the one good thing to come out of all of this thus far. But saying more would give away the game, so let's get back to the Lions. As presented, the Lions get to be a part of this world and still be an analogy of our world, because Albion is meant to represent the British Empire. Indeed, the metaphor is paper-thin in places, as Albion is specifically a term once used to refer to the British Isles by the Romans. And as Toby put it himself, this analogy is a way of pointing a finger directly at the actions of wealthy nations like Britain and America for our past actions through the story of an alien world. And using fiction to reflect on uncomfortable truths of history is actually pretty common. Like, whenever you're doing any commentary on historical stuff, the use of fantasy worlds or science fiction worlds or other just, you know, like non-human settings for storytelling is a way sometimes to talk about the stuff that is part of our own history that we sometimes have difficulty looking at with anything other than rose-colored lenses. obviously in 2020, we have tended to get a ways away from that. Not in all pieces of media, but certainly there have been more than a few within the last 5 years, within the last 10 years, that have looked at this kind of stuff with eyes unwilling to try and put a nicer view on it and to any degree. A lot of the stuff, say, from the 1990s, which is something that Alex and Sharon and company have brought up a great deal in School of Movies recently, are seemingly self-congratulatory in terms of like, oh yeah, this is the way things used to be. We can talk about these things now because things are perfectly fine now. We've overcome racism. No, no, you can see that for yourself just doom scrolling on Twitter right now. So using Tiger's Eye to talk about colonialism and the British Empire and the fact that capitalism and hierarchies always tend to have some basis in creating wealth and prosperity based on the subjugation or mistreatment or outright enslavement of other peoples so that work can be done for paying out peanuts. That's a constant throughout human history, not just with Britain or anything like that. Britain is one of the biggest
empires.
The word I was actually looking for was offenders, although apparently I failed to remember it during the recording. But Toby's word works just as well, because Britain was one of the biggest empires based on the lengths that it was willing to go to maintain its supremacy. But there are elements of that in, you know, ancient Rome. There are very likely elements of that in most great nations. I haven't done a whole lot of research into like China or Japan or anything like that. But even if you look at certain things like, say, Eastern Europe, where a lot of the Russian regimes were horribly despotic or, you know, trotting on the serfs of that era in terms of feudalism, in terms of getting rich off of the labor of others. That's just a common thing. And even as we come to a different world, which so far has set up humanity as being a potential locust-like invading force, much like, say, the aliens in Independence Day or something like that, the greatest threat to people of any kind is just other people. You know, that's simply a unfortunate truism.
Yeah.
You know, I don't necessarily think we need to talk more on that because it just makes me think more and more about current events. So let's try to move on from there unless you had other thoughts.
No, I'm quite content to move past this for now, and because I know we're only going to have to talk more about this next time as we get further into the lions and the whale. So, yes, I'm quite content to go away from there while we still can.
Oh boy, there's just so much stuff that we're going to be getting into. But that's going to be it for this week. Next week, we'll cover our final topics of conversation on chapters 11 through 15, which won't take up more than an hour of your time. After that, we can finally discuss chapters 16 through 20. And based on the total length of our two Skype conversations there, 2 hours, 45 minutes, plus also 2 hours and 47, potentially over 5 hours of material, we likely aren't going to get done discussing Tiger's Eye until March. So we hope you love talking tigers, because we sure did. To play us out this time, something that isn't Afro-Celt. Instead, it's a return to Paul Simon, but not his Rhythm of the Saints album, either. I grew up listening to a lot of my father's music, and one of the artists that stuck with me the most were tracks performed by Simon and Garfunkel from the 70s. But in the 80s, my father bought the solo album by Simon called Graceland. And it was over this album that my father and I bonded a bit. The first track of that album was a song that reflected on darker themes of our modern world, like starvation and terrorism, but wanted to juxtapose them with messages of hope, the kind that was promised by new technology, new medicine, and a better understanding of the natural world. Obviously, 30 years have passed since then, and in the process, we've made even more progress with both sides of this coin. New technologies, new social progress, as well as a host of new fears and dangers. But in writing this song, Simon wanted to come down on the side of hope. And that's a message that is at the heart and center of New Century. So with that in mind, until next time, this is Paul Simon with The Boy in the Bubble.
It's everybody jump started. Every generation throws a hero up the pop charts. Medicine is magical and magical is art. Think of the boy in the bubble and the baby with the babbling heart. And I believe these are days. Lasers in the jungle. Lasers in the jungle somewhere. Staccato signals of constant information. A loose affiliation of millionaires and billionaires.